Hey everyone, and welcome to our deep dive into ADPKD, autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease.
Got it.
Now, whether you're getting ready for a meeting or just catching up on some research, or maybe you're just really curious about this condition, we're here to break it all down for you.
That's right. ADPKD is actually more common than you might think. It affects over 1 in 1,000 people worldwide.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's not just about those cysts in the kidneys either. It can also impact your liver and even your cardiovascular system. So we're really talking about a condition with some pretty serious implications here.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. We know that ADPKD is primarily caused by mutations in two genes, PKD1 and PKD2. Now, these genes are like the blueprints for making these proteins called polycystins, which are essential for keeping our kidneys functioning the right way. But when these blueprints have errors, and we call those mutations, that's when things can start to go wrong.
Right. And to understand why those errors are such a big deal, we need to zoom in on these tiny little hair-like structures in the kidneys called cilia.
Cilia.
Yeah. They act like sensors, helping cells communicate and function correctly. And polycystins play a crucial role in making sure those cilia work as they should.
So if the polycystins aren't working the right way, because of those gene mutations, the cilia get messed up. And that's when we start to see the development of cysts in the kidneys.
Exactly. It's like a domino effect. And it's not just about the kidneys either. Cilia are actually found all over our bodies, which is why ADPKD can have such widespread effects.
Okay, I'm starting to see how these tiny cilia are way more important than they sound. Now, one of the research papers we're diving into today focuses on the fact that not all mutations in PKD1 and PKD2 are created equal. It turns out that where the mutation occurs within the gene can actually influence how severe the disease becomes.
That's right. And one particularly interesting finding is that mutations in the first half of the PKD1 gene seem to be linked to a milder form of ADPKD.
So someone with a mutation in that specific region of the gene might experience a less aggressive form of the disease. That's incredible. But why would the location of the mutation matter so much?
Well, think of it like this. Different parts of a gene can be responsible for creating different parts of a protein. So a mutation in one region might disrupt the protein's function more severely than a mutation in another region.
Makes sense. So a mutation in a critical part of the gene could lead to a polycystin protein that's completely non-functional, resulting in more severe disease. But a mutation in a less critical region might result in a protein that still retains some function, leading to milder symptoms.
That's the idea. And this finding has some important implications for patients. You know, knowing the specific location of a PKD1 mutation could help doctors predict how the disease might progress and tailor treatment accordingly.
So it's not just about knowing you have a mutation. It's about understanding what that mutation means for you as an individual.
Precisely. And this is where the concept of personalized medicine comes in. As we learn more about the relationship between specific mutations and disease severity, we can move towards more targeted treatments that address the individual needs of each patient.
This is all really fascinating. But I have to admit, some of these genetic terms can be a bit tricky to wrap your head around. For example, we've mentioned haploinsufficiency a couple of times. Could you break that down for our listeners who might not be familiar with it?
Sure. Haploinsufficiency basically means that even though you have one good copy of a gene, it's not enough to compensate for the faulty copy. You need both copies working properly to produce enough of the necessary protein.
Ah, so in the case of ADPKD, even having one functional copy of the PKD1 gene might not be enough to produce enough polycystin to keep those cilia working properly.
Exactly. And this is why even individuals with just one PKD1 mutation can still develop the disease.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. So we've talked about genes, mutations, and even these tiny cilia. But one of the research papers we're looking at today goes in a completely different direction. It explores the role of PKD1 and PKD2 in embryos.
That's right. We tend to associate these genes with kidney disease, but it turns out they're busy at work long before kidneys are even fully formed.
So what are these genes up to during those early stages of development?
Well, this research found that PKD1 and PKD2 are expressed in a variety of tissues in embryos as young as 5 to 6 weeks old. We're talking about the heart, the neural tube, even the aorta.
Wow, that's a wide reach. What does that tell us about the role of these genes?
It suggests that PKD1 and PKD2 might be involved in a whole range of developmental processes that we're just beginning to understand. And it highlights the importance of these genes for overall health, not just kidney function.
Okay, so these genes are like multitasking masters, playing different roles in different tissues at different times. And speaking of different roles, one of the studies we came across found that the PKD1 gene might actually be a potential biomarker in a completely different disease, triple-negative breast cancer.
That's right, and it was a pretty surprising finding. It seems that high levels of PKD1 mRNA, the molecule that carries instructions from the gene, are associated with a poorer prognosis in this type of breast cancer.
So the same gene that's involved in kidney cysts might also play a role in how aggressive a certain type of breast cancer becomes. That's mind-blowing. But how is that even possible?
Well, it highlights the fact that biological systems are incredibly interconnected. Genes and proteins often have multiple functions, and pathways that are important in one disease can also play a role in seemingly unrelated conditions.
It's like a tangled web of interactions, where one thread can lead you to unexpected places.
Exactly, and this finding opens up all sorts of intriguing questions for future research. Could targeting PKD1 be a potential therapeutic strategy for both ADPKD and certain types of breast cancer? It's definitely worth investigating further.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground already, from genes and mutations to tiny cilia and even a surprising link to breast cancer. But let's bring it back to the kidneys for a moment. One of the papers we're looking at today focuses on a specific type of kidney injury called ischemia reperfusion injury.
Ah, yes. This is where there's a temporary interruption of blood flow to the kidneys, followed by the restoration of blood flow. Think of it like a temporary power outage for the kidneys.
And this type of injury can be quite damaging, right? Especially for people who already have underlying kidney problems.
Absolutely. And what the study found is that mice with only one functioning copy of the PKD1 gene experienced more severe kidney damage after ischemia reperfusion injury, compared to mice with two functional copies.
So even though those mice had one good copy of the gene, they were still more vulnerable to this type of kidney injury.
Exactly. It reinforces the idea that even a single PKD1 mutation can have a significant impact on kidney health. And it raises the question, could this finding translate to humans? Are individuals with just one PKD1 mutation more susceptible to acute kidney injury in situations where blood flow to the kidneys might be compromised?
That's a crucial question. If that's the case, it could have implications for how we manage and monitor ADPKD patients, especially in situations like surgery or certain medical procedures where blood flow might be temporarily interrupted.
It highlights the importance of understanding the full range of risks associated with ADPKD, even beyond the development of cysts.
Now get this. One of the studies we're diving into involved introducing the PKD1 gene into a type of kidney cell called MDCK cells, which are commonly used in research. And the results were pretty astonishing.
You're telling me.
They began spontaneously forming tubes, like they were trying to build their own tiny kitties right there in the lab. It's like the PKD1 gene gave them the blueprint and instructions to start constructing tubular structures.
Precisely. And this finding has incredible implications for the future of ADPKD treatment. If scientists can figure out how to harness this tubule-forming power of the PKD1 gene, imagine the possibilities.
I'm on the edge of my seat. Tell me more.
What if we could stimulate the regeneration of damaged kidney tissue? Or even grow new healthy kidney tissue from scratch? It's a bold idea, but this study suggests it might not be as far-fetched as it sounds.
That would be absolutely revolutionary for ADPKD patients. It's like science fiction coming to life.
It certainly is, and it underscores how even the most fundamental research can pave the way for incredible breakthroughs.
This deep dive has been an absolute whirlwind of information. We've gone from genes and mutations to tiny cilia, a surprising link to breast cancer. And now, the potential for regenerating kidney tissue.
It's amazing how much we're learning about this complex disease.
But before we wrap up part one of our deep dive, I want to touch on one more important concept, modifier genes.
Ah, yes. Modifier genes, the supporting actors in the ADPKD story.
They don't directly cause the disease, but they can influence how it progresses.
Exactly. Think of them as the stage crew setting the scene and influencing how the main actors perform. They can affect things like the age at which symptoms appear, the severity of those symptoms, and even the rate at which kidney function declines.
So two people with the same PKD1 mutation could have very different experiences with ADPKD, depending on their unique set of modifier genes.
That's the key takeaway. It adds another layer of complexity to this already intricate disease and highlights the need for personalized approaches to treatment.
Welcome back. It's remarkable how much we're uncovering about this ADPKD.
It really is. And you know, one thing that keeps coming up is just how much variation there is in how this disease plays out. It's not a one-size-fits-all situation at all.
No, it's not.
Remember how we were talking about how that location of the PKD1 mutation could affect disease severity?
Yeah.
Well, one of the studies we dug into actually looked at that in detail.
Oh, yeah, the one that mapped out all the PKD1 mutations and compared them to how well the patient's kidneys were actually functioning.
That's the one. They found that mutations in a very specific section of the gene, between nucleotide 0 and 7EM1 to be exact, were often linked to a milder form of ADPKD.
Wow, so where that mutation hits on that gene seems to really matter. This underscores why genetic testing is so important, right? It's not just about knowing if you have a mutation.
Right.
It's about understanding what that specific mutation might mean for you.
Exactly. It's all about getting that personalized picture.
Okay, so we've talked about genes, mutations, those kinase cilia. But one of the papers went in a totally different direction.
Yeah.
It focused on PKD1 and PKD2 in embryos.
Ah, yes, the one that found those genes active. During very early human development, even in places you wouldn't expect, like outside the kidneys.
Right. They found signs of both PKD1 and PKD2, both the instructions to make the protein and the protein itself. In embryos as young as 5 or 6 weeks old.
And not just in the kidneys. They were popping up in the heart, the neural tube, spinal ganglia, even the aorta. It makes you wonder if there are other roles for these genes that we haven't even thought of yet.
It's like they're laying the foundation for all sorts of things, not just the kidneys.
Exactly.
They're busy little bees during those early stages.
Exactly. And it gets even more interesting. The study found that the pattern of these genes being active actually changes as the kidneys develop.
So it's not just that they're there. It's that their activity level shifts over time.
Exactly. In fetal kidneys, you see a lot of PKD1 activity. In the proximal tubules, which are the parts that reabsorb nutrients. But as the kidneys mature, PKD1 shifts its focus to the distal tubules and collecting ducts, the parts that fine-tune urine concentration.
So it's like they have a carefully planned route, changing their focus. As the kidneys grow and mature, and any missteps in that process could lead to problems later on.
Precisely. And that's where some of the other research comes in. One study looked at ischemia reperfusion injury.
Right, that's where blood flow to the kidneys is temporarily cut off and then restored, kind of like a mini power outage for the kidneys, as you said earlier.
Good analogy. And this study found that mice with only one working copy of the PKD1 gene had much worse kidney damage after that kind of injury.
Even though they had one good copy, that's a bit worrisome.
It is. It suggests that even people with a single PKD1 mutation might be more prone to acute kidney injury, especially in situations where blood flow to the kidneys could be compromised.
So things like surgery, maybe even certain medications, could pose a higher risk.
It's a possibility, and it reinforces the need for careful monitoring and preventative measures for ADPKD patients. We need to understand all the potential risks, not just focus on cyst formation.
Okay, remember that study where they put the PKD1 gene into MDCK cells? Those are the kidney cells often used in research.
Oh, yes. And those cells started doing something remarkable.
They began spontaneously forming tubes, like they were trying to build their own tiny kidneys right there in the dish. It's like the PKD1 gene gave them the blueprint instructions to become little kidney engineers.
It's incredible, isn't it? And it suggests that polycystin-1, the protein made from the PKD1 gene, might play a key role in directing kidney development. What if we could harness that power to actually regenerate damaged kidney tissue?
It's like science fiction becoming reality. We could potentially repair kidneys or even grow new ones.
It's definitely a long-term goal, but this kind of research gives us hope.
Speaking of hope, I remember another study that looked into modifier genes in ADPKD.
Ah, yes. Those genes that don't directly cause the disease, but can influence how it unfolds.
Right, like the supporting cast in a play. They can influence how early symptoms appear, how severe those symptoms get, even how fast kidney function declines.
Exactly. It's another reason why ADPKD can look so different. From person to person, two people with the same PKD1 mutation could have vastly different experiences based on their unique set of modifier genes.
So even though we're talking about genetics, it's not as straightforward as it might seem. There's a lot of nuance and individual variation at play.
Absolutely. And that's why understanding these modifier genes is so crucial for developing personalized treatment approaches.
Speaking of personalized approaches, one of the papers focused on finding ways to diagnose and monitor ADPKD less invasively. They were looking at urinary exosomes.
Ah, yes, those tiny packages released by cells that carry all sorts of information about what's going on inside the body. It's like they're little messengers traveling through our bodily fluids.
Exactly. And the researchers found that the ratio of certain proteins within those urinary exosomes could actually distinguish between people with PKD1 mutations and those without.
That's a huge finding. It means we might be able to diagnose ADPKD earlier and track its progression with a simple, non-invasive urine test.
No more biopsies or complicated imaging studies, just a simple P-test. It could be a game changer for patients, allowing for earlier interventions and potentially slowing down the disease's progression.
It would make monitoring much easier and less stressful for patients as well.
Now, this next study blew my mind. It turns out PKD1, the gene we've been talking about all this time, might actually be involved in something completely different, triple-negative breast cancer.
I know, right? It's a reminder that the body is an incredibly complex and interconnected system.
Right.
Who would have thought that a gene primarily known for its role in kidney cysts could also be linked to breast cancer?
Apparently, high levels of PKD1 mRNA, that's the molecule that carries instructions from the gene, are associated with a worse outcome in triple-negative breast cancer. So the same gene, different disease, potentially very different impacts.
It's a fantastic example of how a single gene can have multiple roles in the body. And it opens up new avenues of research. Could targeting PKD1 be a potential therapeutic strategy for both ADPKD and certain types of breast cancer? It's a question worth exploring.
It's truly amazing how interconnected things are. But let's shift our focus back to how cysts actually form in ADPKD. One of the papers went deep into the chain reaction. That leads to these fluid-filled sacs developing.
Right. It all starts with those tiny cilia we talked about earlier. When they're not functioning properly, due to those PKD1 or PKD2 mutations, it sets off a cascade of events.
Like a domino effect. First, the cilia dysfunction disrupts the delicate balance within the kidney tubules.
That leads to cells multiplying more than they should, fluid secretion increases, and voila, cysts start to form.
It's like a chain reaction, one thing leading to another, ultimately resulting in the hallmark feature of ADPKD.
And understanding this cascade of events is key for developing targeted therapies that can interrupt the process and prevent or slow down cyst formation.
It's like trying to find the weak link in a chain and figure out how to break it.
Exactly. That's the ultimate goal, to stop this process in its tracks and prevent the progression of ADPKD.
One study used a clever technique called tetraploid aggregation to investigate why embryos with certain PKD1 mutations often don't survive. It's a way to study placental development.
Right. They essentially combined cells from two different embryos, one with the PKD1 mutation and one without.
And they found that the embryos with the PKD1 mutation had problems with their placentas, specifically in a layer called the labyrinth.
The labyrinth is crucial for exchanging nutrients and waste between the mother and the developing embryo. Any problems there can have serious consequences.
And by giving those embryos a healthy placenta from the other embryo, they were able to rescue some of them. They survived longer, showing just how important the placenta is for embryos with PKD1 mutations.
It really emphasizes the interconnectedness of different developmental processes. Problems in one area, like the placenta, can have ripple effects throughout the developing embryo.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground in this part of our deep dive. From embryonic development to the cascade of events leading to cyst formation, it's clear that ADPKD research is making significant progress. What other fascinating insights await us? Stay tuned for the final part of our deep dive. Welcome back to the final part of our ADPKD deep dive.
It's been quite a journey, hasn't it?
It really has. And you know, one thing that's really struck me is just how much research is being done to understand this complex disease. It feels like scientists are attacking it from every angle.
You're absolutely right. We've seen studies looking at the genetics, the cellular mechanisms, potential biomarkers, even new therapeutic targets. It's a multi-pronged approach.
And it's giving us real hope for the future of ADPKD treatment. Speaking of which, one study we looked at explored a potential new target, a protein called TMEM2.
Ah, yes. That study found that TMEPK levels were higher in the urinary exosomes of people with PKD1 mutations.
Not only that, but the ratio of PC1 to TMEM2 in those exosomes could actually differentiate between folks with and without PKD1 mutations. That's pretty amazing.
It is. It suggests that TMEM2 could be a valuable biomarker for ADPKD, potentially helping us diagnose it earlier and tailor treatment strategies.
And maybe even target it directly with new therapies. Imagine a drug that could modulate TMEM2 levels and slow down the progression of ADPKD.
Now that would be a game changer. But of course, more research is needed to fully understand the role of TMEM2 and explore its potential as a therapeutic target. It's promising, but we need to be cautious and do our due diligence.
Okay, back to the cellular level for a moment. One study looked at how PKD1 affects cell survival.
Oh yes, the one where they found that overexpressing PKD1 in those MDCK cells made them more resistant to apoptosis. That's programmed cell death.
So it's like boosting PKD1 gave those cells a survival advantage, making them tougher and less likely to die.
Exactly. And this finding has interesting implications for ADPKD. If a lack of PKD1 function contributes to increased cell death in cystic kidneys, that could further speed up the disease's progression.
Another piece of the puzzle falls into place. It helps us understand the intricate dance of cellular processes in ADPKD.
You know, as we've been going through these research papers, it's become clear that ADPKD research is a truly global effort.
Absolutely. We've seen studies from all over the world, with researchers collaborating and sharing their findings.
Remember that study we talked about earlier? With researchers from Brazil and the United States.
The one looking at ischemia reperfusion injury in mice with PKD1 mutations.
Exactly. That kind of collaboration is essential. It lets us pool resources, share expertise, and get different perspectives, which ultimately speeds up the pace of discovery.
It's like a global brain trust working together to unravel the mysteries of ADPKD.
And that's what makes this field so exciting. There's a shared purpose, a collective drive to make a difference in the lives of people affected by this challenging disease.
Well, dear listener, our deep dive into the world of ADPKD has come to an end. We've covered a lot of ground, from genes and proteins to those tiny cilia, potential biomarkers, and even the possibility of regenerating kidney tissue.
It's been a whirlwind of information, but we hope you found it as fascinating as we have.
ADPKD research is a dynamic and rapidly evolving field. There's still so much to learn. But each new discovery brings us closer to understanding, treating, and ultimately conquering this complex disease.
So as we wrap up, we want to leave you with this thought. Keep asking questions, stay curious, and never underestimate the power of scientific inquiry.
Because who knows what groundbreaking discoveries lie just around the corner. Maybe the cure for ADPKD is closer than we think. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep exploring the decks of knowledge.